Welcome to Nightchild Talks Prince, uncut and unscripted.
So today, well, I mean, I was thinking, I always do this, but I should let you introduce yourself, because I always think I said that to Vicky. I said, you know, it's weird when people introduce other people and you think, let them introduce themselves. They can say exactly what they want to say. So how would you introduce yourself?
Hello, everybody. Hello, everybody. I'm Chris Johnson. I'm the creator and host of the Purple Nights podcast on YouTube, Spotify, Blog Talk Radio, and Apple Podcasts. And we're on social media. We're on Twitter, or X now, as they call it, but I always call it Twitter.
Yeah.
Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, although I don't update my TikTok as often as I should, because I'm an old fart. But I'm happy to be here. I'm a friend of Nightchild's for many, many years now, and it's a pleasure to be on Nightchild Talks Prince, uncut and unscripted.
Oh, thank you. It's a brave new world with TikTok. I feel I'm getting older every day. I'm convinced that all the kids will discover something new, and then TikTok will be old, and I'll be another step behind, and I'll just never catch up.
It's
incredible.
I mean, let's face it, we're old men at this point. So
yeah,
exactly.
We've got to think of a kind of good term for us, haven't we? I think some people call us was it seasoned? We're seasoned fans.
Seasoned veterans, as they say.
That's a nice way of putting it. Yes. And today we're going to talk about Netflix. Now, oh wow. I think it's a weird situation at the moment. So how do you feel about the whole saga, I suppose, because it's been going on now for some time, the idea of having this Prince Netflix documentary? I mean, it's been a long time in this sort of gestation, but how do you see it all?
Well, today, as we're recording this, it's 8 years since Prince passed. And it's 7 years since the Netflix documentary was officially announced. So that's how long this saga has been going on. And it's just really, really frustrating, because I don't think we've had a really quality Prince documentary since about 91 with the Omnibus documentary, sometimes known as the Prince of Paisley Park. I don't think we've had a really top-notch documentary project since then. And of course, that only covers up until either the Act 2 tour or something like that. Act 1, I believe. So we need a, you know, proper retrospective that covers pretty much the entire four decades of Prince's career. And I know for myself, and probably for many other, you know, true funk soldiers out there, this documentary was our last best hope, so to speak, of having a career spanning, you know, top notch documentary series going on. And there's a lot of rumors and speculation floating around still 7 years later about what exactly is going on behind the scenes. But I'm not one really for, you know, dabbling in rumor or speculation or, you know, slander of the people involved. I know there are some people out there that are a little less than careful, shall we say, about their criticism of the estate and its management. But I try to be on the more cautious diplomatic side of things, because that's just that's just my nature. It always has been. And I would rather be safe than in the crosshairs of somebody much more powerful with many more resources than I have. So that's where I stand on that. But yeah, there's been a lot of speculation about, you know, what the documentary can entail. And lately, the past couple of years, a lot of speculation on why it's being held back, you know, held in abeyance. And of course, there's all the related talk about Netflix having the first right of refusal as far as when it comes to footage, either video or audio. And there's speculation as to the point that right that Netflix holds is maybe the chief reason why the music isn't being dispersed as fast as we would like, and the video content isn't being dispersed as fast as we would like. So only those in charge really know the truth of what's going on. But I guess today we're just going to talk about our opinions a little bit and try to keep it as positive as we can on this solemn occasion of 8 years since Prince's transcendence. And I don't know, Jay, what are your thoughts on how I just broke it down there?
That was amazing. I am so glad you came on. I was such a big fan of yours right from, you know, years ago, and you just loved your podcast, love the things you do, and the way you talk, and that that was amazing. And like you said, I can't believe it's been 7 years. I mean, I didn't realize that's such an incredibly long time. And I don't know about in America, but in the UK, what happens is if we ever get Prince documentaries, they're usually about an hour or 45 minutes. And what happens is they kind of focus on 1999, Purple Rain. They get to Purple Rain. They spend a long time on Purple Rain. They'll mention maybe Side of the Times of Batman. And then after that, they kind of speed up. They might mention Diamonds and Pearls, and they'll briefly mention the Super Bowl if you're lucky. But basically, the last 20 years, it's like if it's an hour long, by the time it gets to about 10 minutes to go, they're still at sort of, you know, 2004, 2005. And then they just speed through the last bit of his career as if it didn't really happen. They sort of, it's never gone into in depth. And I think that's frustrating for people, you know, like us, who realize that Prince, you know, did so many different things in so many different eras, and he's not just Purple Rain. And I don't want people to have that impression that he's just Purple Rain. So I think one of the things I was really hoping for is when they talked about this documentary, they talked about it being, you know, 8-10 parts, and I thought if this could be a really in-depth, that would be fantastic. And it was interesting to me because at first, obviously, you know, back when Ava DuVernay was kind of at the helm, it was really there was a sense that, you know, she was very, very respected and was going to do an amazing job. Then obviously she left the project, and obviously we don't really know why. I think she just said it was creative differences, but you can't, that sort of, we don't really know the ins and outs of why that was. And now it's been taken over. Is it Ezra Elderman, who is directed the O.J. Simpson documentary, and that's obviously well received. I haven't seen it myself, but I know it's sort of highly rated, and people were talking about the kind of job he would do. But there's obviously not been much communication from, you know, anybody really about what's happening. Like you say, you hear little snippets, you hear things people say, and people say, "Oh, I was interviewed and I didn't like this or I didn't like that," but you don't know, you know, the whole thing. But the thing you really hit upon that really fascinates me is that this delay is extraordinary, really, when you think of the period of time. And if it is true that you know, so much being held up, or they've basically got, from what we hear, kind of first rights on a lot of stuff that they have to put their documentary out first. And you worry, you think, is this holding up a lot of things that could be released and that the estate perhaps want to put out? But if this deal says, well, Netflix get their first sort of bite of the apple, the problem with that is obviously we're 7 years on now, so that's a long time to wait for. We're very impatient as Prince fans. We want all of it, and we want it now, and we want more, and we want, you know, everything we could possibly get. And it's just fascinating how there's not a lot coming out. I mean, I know some Prince associated people have talked about sort of being interviewed, so there's obviously some work that's gone on. But I don't know, because I presume the documentary is going to have access to things that we've never seen before, things from the vault, video clips, music clips, and that's going to be interesting. But it's also, it's difficult because even with 10 hours, you couldn't put everything that Prince did in it. And also, I can understand, and it's difficult because on one hand, I don't want people to kind of assume the worst. And there's always that saying that you should sort of expect the best but prepare for the worst. And I know people are worried. They think, well, is there going to be salacious things? Is it going to sort of delve into his private life in ways that are controversial and things like that? And obviously Netflix, for their part, want to do a good job, but they also want as many people to watch it as possible, Prince fans and people who aren't really Prince fans but just know a little bit about Prince. So I think I can understand what they're worried about. But the trouble is, I suppose all this time gives people time to worry and time to, just stress about what could be happening and what couldn't. I mean, this could be the best thing ever. This could be amazing. This could be amazing, or it could be controversial. And for me, the thing that I think, honestly, I think this could shape the way the wider public view Prince for 5-10 years. Because if this is a major landmark thing, Netflix, obviously huge, you know, they have millions and millions and millions of viewers. And this is going to be a huge thing. And you think whatever's in that documentary is going to very much shape how people view Prince, who perhaps it may change people who are Prince fans slightly, their opinion. But it also certainly will change people who don't know Prince's work particularly deeply. So I think it's so crucial to get it right. It's a big responsibility. So I feel the pressure on the director must be immense.
Right. Well, in terms of it being salacious, you know, and impacting the public view of Prince as an artist, as a person, or what have you, I feel like cancel culture is so prevalent in today's world, and it's so hypercritical, and you know, it's very much, you know, people are very much ready and willing to cancel people immediately for the smallest of things. And we have to remember that, you know, 30, 40 years ago, it was a different world. You know, a lot of things were more culturally acceptable and less frowned upon and less criticized than they are today. And so maybe viewing certain aspects of Prince's story, you know, through the 2024 lens, I think there would be sufficient grounds for the cancel ralliers to really latch onto and say, oh, Prince was horrible, you know, he was racist or anti-Semitic or sexist or homophobic, you know, and therefore he doesn't deserve our time or our, you know, our respect. And I think that's just ridiculous, personally. I hate to be too bold with my opinions, but personally, I think over the last 20, 30 years or so, people have become almost too sensitive. You know, I look at something like comedy, you know, stand-up comedy. You know, people can't seem to take jokes anymore without being seriously offended by the smallest little thing. And it's concerning because I think in humor, you know, with comedy, there's a kernel of cruelty in all humor at some point. So, you know, certain things like that with society, you know, I think we've become too sensitive and too hyper alert for the smallest, you know, sign of affront or offense. And I think that's what really concerns me and annoys me quite a bit about cancel culture. So, of course, there are going to be those that, you know, look badly on Prince and say, you know, let's cancel him. And we all know the, you know, criticisms that are already out there about, you know, him dating younger women. And that's as far as I'll go with that. But you know what I'm insinuating, Jay. And yeah, I just think society as a whole has become too sensitive. I mean, everybody takes everything so seriously now. And it's just like, you know, I'm not excusing that behavior, but at the same time, I'm like, you know, lighten up. It's not that bad, not that serious. You know, we're all human. We're all prone to mistakes. We're all prone to vice, and we're all prone to sin, you know. So to get a little spiritual there, but yeah, so I'm worried and concerned and annoyed by the prevalence of cancel culture, and I definitely think it's an element to be wary of in terms of the Prince documentary, because we all know Prince was a taskmaster. You know, he was really, really strict in terms of rehearsal, in terms of his audio engineers. You know, he worked them to the, he worked their fingers to the bone, so to speak. And even that, you know, nowadays, in certain respects, will be looked upon as, you know, as, you know, inhuman or cruel in a sense, to work these people to the point of exhaustion.
I think that's a good point, because I think when you talk about, you know, there are certain band members who said, you know, he would work 30, 35 hours straight, or it would be Christmas and he'd want people in. And I think the thing is, I wonder what it's going to be like in 20 years time, because I'm pretty confident there are things that people say and do today that in 20 years time, people will look back on and say, oh, I can't believe they did that. I mean, we have a program here in the UK where they show things from the 1970s. And yep. We look back and we go, oh, I can't believe they thought that or they did that. And I think the ironic thing is everybody thinks they're at that kind of moment of moral purity. And yet in 20 years' time, we'll probably look back on this time and think, oh, what were they talking about? What were they doing? What were they thinking? And it's one of those things that is very difficult. I mean, if you go back to, say, fairly near the beginning, say even like the Dirty Mind era, and you think about that now, and you think about if somebody came out with some of those songs he came out with then, now, and it's interesting, because the thing about Prince that I love is that he was very open with his journey, that he kind of had his philosophy and he shared it with everybody, and all his thoughts were out there, and he was searching and looking and developing. And you, especially if you look at the, you know, the beginning of his career, the way he changed throughout his career. I mean, if you compare, I suppose, Dirty Mind with Rainbow Children. You almost couldn't have two further kind of different ideas, but it was all Prince. He was searching for these ideas and this philosophy. And I think that's the thing that's really important, that people change, they develop, they do different things, they have different ideas. And from being a young man, he came from the background he came from, kind of broken home. He said at times he sort of felt quite angry. He wanted to prove to the world that he could kind of do this, you know, this create this amazing art. And he was very driven. And I think that kind of it's very easy to forget how much he achieved. And he didn't come from, you know, any kind of privilege or anything like that. He had to do it all himself, and he worked incredibly hard. And I think they said, there was a quote once where they talked about, was being poor, was that what motivated you? He said, well, no, it was just the fact that he knew because he was poor, he'd have to work really hard to kind of succeed and to do well. And when I look at his drive, it's incredible because it didn't let up. He could have easily got to say Purple Rain and say, right, I've made loads of money now, I can just, you know, relax a little bit. I can just do an album every 3 or 4 years, maybe. You know what the record company wanted, say, do an album every 3 or 4 years, tour it, we'll make loads of videos, we'll make loads of money, and that's it. But he was very much, he wanted to be, you know, he was a true artist. And whether that meant fighting the record company or doing albums which may have been not the most commercial albums, but they were things that he was really into, is a key point. And I just hope this documentary, there's so much of Prince that's so positive. I mean, we know about, well, we know probably the tip of the iceberg of his charitable work, his philanthropy and the things he's done. And a lot of that he kept quiet. And I know when I went to the Afshin Shahidi, the photographer, exhibition about the book he produced about Prince, that Prince would often go to these charitable places quietly. He wouldn't tell anybody, and Afshin would take photos and Prince would look at them, but he'd say, you know, we don't put these out because that's not why we do charity. We do charity to help people, we do charity to make people's lives better. And I hope it has that. You need somebody at the project who just really realizes the achievement Prince did. I mean, you look at the artists now around, even the artists now who are very, very high profile in terms of, say, Beyonce, in terms of Alicia Keys. You talk about you know, Bruno Mars. There's so many who are just influenced by Prince, and say Prince is like a you know, a mentor or somebody they admired, and his influence. And not only that, in terms of what he did to the record industry as well. I mean, we're talking about Taylor Swift nowadays, re-recording and getting home masters, and that was something that Prince was at the, you know, really at the forefront of in many ways. And at the time, people didn't really understand. They didn't really understand what was going on. Certainly in the UK, they sort of mocked him. They thought it was silly. They didn't really understand what he was trying to do. And I hope all that gets explored, because, like you say, it's easy to make a kind of, how should I put it nicely, a kind of, you know, tabloidy sort of shock kind of, you know, National Enquirer-esque kind of thing. But I think Prince deserves the best. And that's interesting because there was a tweet, I think, a while ago from Londell McMillan, and I haven't got it word for word, but it was basically saying he wouldn't allow anything in the documentary to sort of portray Prince in that negative, that bad light. And I think that's interesting because that it's reassuring in the sense of the estate obviously still have, you know, have this say in it. I presume they own Prince's work now, but also it's important that they defend and make sure that is done with absolute care, because I would rather that sounds terrible. I mean, I want it to happen, but I'd rather it not come out if it's terrible and bad than it come out. I would rather have something that does Prince as much justice as it can, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I can agree with that, but at the same point, you know, I would think that it's, you know, the filmmaker Ezra Edelman won awards and accolades for his OJ documentary, and you have a huge, you know, multinational corporation like Netflix backing it and signing off on it, so I can't imagine that it would be bad by any stretch of the term just because you have those two factors enormous favor of it being a, you know, a tremendous quality project. So I understand those concerns, but
and the thing is, they're going to have access to presumably the from things from the estate of high quality, things, you know, we haven't seen. Yes. And that's the thing. And also, I presume if Netflix asked to talk to anybody who worked in the Prince world, most people are going to jump up and say, yes, I'll talk to Prince. And you get to hear, hopefully, from not only band members, but, you know, engineers, photographers, people behind the scenes, people perhaps we haven't heard from before. So they've got the budget to do that and to do it well. They can travel to places and say, I mean, Netflix's budget is huge and they can pretty much do whatever needs to be done. So, I mean,
yes,
I think the thing is, I just worry because we haven't heard anything. It may be one of those things where,
yes,
if it appeared, yes, on a schedule, if they said, oh, it's coming in 6 months time, or it's going to be released, you know, at a certain point, I think that would get something kind of locked in. But I think the other thing is also, when they release it, I wonder if they will coincide that with a release of music to kind of complement that. So people who see the, yes, documentary can go out and buy something, you know?
Yes. Yes. A physical release of a soundtrack would be the ideal. Like I said earlier, I'm an old fart, so I love physical media above all else. But even a digital release, you know, a documentary soundtrack, as it were, would be tremendous. And yeah, that's the most exciting prospect of everything to me with this documentary, is the unseen footage, the unknown songs, the unknown videos. You know, and excuse me, to go back to your point of, you know, not knowing, you know, what it's going to be like. You know, it's the fear of the unknown that really causes you to be, you know, doubtful about certain aspects of it. And it's so true, because, you know, we really don't know much of anything at this point when it comes down to it. So when you reflect on it, I know I myself go down this, you know, strange mental spiral where, you know, all of a sudden my thoughts get more intense and worse, like, oh my gosh, you know, what if it's terrible? What if it's, like you say, tabloidy and National Enquirer, like, you know? And I know there are, you know, we know the elephant in the room is Prince's opioid addiction. And Jay, you spoke to the point earlier where Netflix and certainly the estate know that the documentary has to appeal to the wider audience outside of the hardcore Prince fan base. And, you know, everybody, the public at large, is, to be quite honest, fixated on the manner and the events surrounding Prince's death. So one of the best ways to ensure that, you know, it will be seen and consumed and talked about by the public is to have a substantial segment of, I would guess, the end of the documentary series, to focus on those events and those, you know, hours and days that we'd rather not, you know, reflect on as hardcore Prince fans who love him and miss him so much, so dearly, especially today.
I think that's a good opportunity as well, because I know that in terms of talking about opioids, because obviously in America, and it's starting, yes, here now, it's becoming more so in the UK, but in America, obviously, it's a huge issue. And you see the work by Chaz Smith, Prince's cousin trying to sort of talk about the opioid addiction and talk about the things that have happened. And it's an opportunity almost to have a kind of wider debate about the damage it's doing to society and to get people to come forward and to try and do something about this thing, because the amount of people across Europe, across America who are dying is just horrific. And to have that conversation, I think sometimes it can serve as a, I mean, for example, in the UK, we had recently, we had two of our royal family diagnosed with cancer. And it, one of the things it allowed was it allowed people to talk about cancer, and people talked about their experiences and they talked about the illness. And I think possibly one way they could approach this is to make this a wider thing about this is something that's happening and we need to talk about. And like you say, you can talk about it sensitively, but also talk about it as a moment where something positive can somehow come out of it in terms of just trying to have that discussion and open it up, because it's a huge thing. I mean, the scale of it, I'd seen a few documentaries, but I had no idea of the scale of it. I didn't realize just how widespread it is. And I think that's one of the things that if they do that really well, if they really hit home and connect with people, that can make a big difference. I mean, it's also interesting when you mention about the wider audience, because what do you think of the potential for this documentary to bring in people who are either not Prince fans or, you know of Prince, but they don't really know huge amounts about him? Do you think this has a potential to start new fans off on a journey of Prince?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the major goals, right, is to you know, ensure that his legacy goes on for generations to come. And in order for that to happen, we need the younger generations to come on board at some point, because, you know, it's a war of attrition. You know, we're all going to go up the ladder at some point. So we need those in front of us to carry the torch. And in order to do that, they need to, you know, get on the funk train to begin with. So, it's very important for the documentary also as well to, you know, attract that new generation and, you know, really get them on board and interested and excited in the music and the, you know, all the media, like the movies and the concerts and live shows and, you know, everything, you know, just like we are, for the next generation, because we want that next generation of Prince nerds, you know? So
it's so true. I hope that in an ideal world, people would watch the documentary. And like you say, that'd be a brilliant idea to have a soundtrack, and the soundtrack could contain different songs from different eras, and they would like those songs, and then they would go off into the albums. And I think also there's lots of ways into this, because there's Prince's musical performance, his vocals, there's his whole journey, the way he changed the music industry, there's his activism. There's so many ways into this. There's so many different interesting aspects that people can connect to. And I think, I don't think there's anybody who wouldn't connect with certain parts of Prince's life. There's so many different things he did. And, you know, he was, you know, sexually avant-garde. He was, he had deep religion. He explored things. He talked about social commentary. And I think there's so many different ways. For me, there's not many artists when you can say you could do a 10-hour documentary and still not really get it all in. I mean, there's so much to do. I always hoped that one day they would put concerts on Netflix as well, just to put that alongside, so you could watch the documentary and then you could go and watch, I don't know, Musicology, or you could watch 21 Nights, or you could watch whatever, and you go on Netflix, have a concert in high definition, and people see Prince live. Because I think when people see Prince live, that's it. So many people were just hooked from that moment.
I just had a great thought about that. What if in the vault somewhere there's footage, either video or audio or both, of Prince's very first show at the Capri Theater?
Oh.
Could you imagine that being on Netflix and then bookend that with something from the Piano and Mike tour and have it be a two-part concert event with the first concert and then perhaps, you know, the Atlanta concert from April 14th, 2016. That would be perfect in my estimation, you know, because you would have the Alpha and you would have the Omega.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I mean, certainly with Piano and Microphone, we know it was all, you know, professionally filmed and done so many. He filmed pretty much everything. And the quality of that, I imagine, would be incredible.
Right.
Absolutely incredible.
And it's been rumored that the audio of the Capri show, at least the audio, it's been rumored that was professionally recorded. So even if there's no video to the audio of that concert, something can be done with photos or, you know, animation or something to make it into a Netflix, you know, watchable commodity. You know, even if it is audio only, there could be some sort of visual element added to make it viable for, you know, streaming on Netflix. But
that would be so good.
Oh my goodness, that would be the ideal.
Oh.
So I hope if the powers that be are listening, you know, Mr. Lundell, Mr. McMillan, Mr. Spicer, if you're listening, you know, if that idea is viable or not, I have no idea, you know, economically, logistically, but if it can happen, that would be like a dream scenario for a lot of us. And yeah, Jay, to go back to your point earlier about, you know, I was really thinking, yeah, there are two sides of the coin. On one side, you know, the estate wants to be respectful of Prince and keep his reputation as, you know, positive as possible. But on the other side, like you say, there is that opportunity to learn and to make people aware of the opioid epidemic and how widespread and how serious it is. And there's a real value to, you know, creating an environment to talk and discuss and really express opinions and thoughts about the crisis, because we can't fix what we ignore. We can't fix what we suppress. We can't fix what we censor. So in order to fix the problem, in order to solve the problem, it must be visible. It must be out there. It must be talked about. It must be thought about. It must be considered. It must be endured, you know.
That's such a key point. I don't think people realize also, I mean, they're not necessarily strictly comparable things, but we see the kind of the toil being incredibly famous takes, obviously famously Michael Jackson. Even the other day, I mean, it's to a lesser extent, but I saw Madonna and she was on stage and her legs were strapped up with things to help her and sort of bandages and things. And you think the toil it takes performing at that level that long and how hard he worked, and people think, oh, it must be lovely to be famous. You have this, but the whole world obviously is interested in everything you do, and the pressure, the relentless pressure, and the constant, and especially with Prince, because he would obviously, you know, rehearse He'd, you know, the concert, he'd do an after show, he'd record, he wouldn't stop. And I think that's, it takes a toil. And he worked so incredibly hard. I mean, I still can't understand how he did all he did in one lifetime. I don't understand how he did it. It's just mind-boggling. To me, the you see Dwayne Tudau's book and you see every day Prince did this, he did this, he did this. And it's just incredible. And I think it's an important conversation to have, because ultimately, you know, Prince was human and he dealt with so much and did so much. And I think, you know, like you say, this is a good opportunity to actually just have those conversations. Sometimes they're difficult, but that's, like you say, that's important. Otherwise, you know, we don't get to the truth. And I think, yeah, that's absolutely a key thing. I mean, I'm hopeful. I say I'm hopeful, but I think there's a good chance that, you know, if they can do this right, this could be, you know, just an amazing thing. And I find that Prince isn't known about to the extent, I mean, I'm obviously biased, but he isn't known about to the extent that I kind of feel he should be. And I know the estate obviously want to keep the positive aspects and the incredible things he did. And I think that's really important. But I think he should be more kind of understood and more appreciated, because he did everything. And I don't think there's really an artist like him. And I just hope that can boost the appreciation of Prince. I mean, I know in certainly UK, I imagine in America, when it's a slightly different thing, but when the Bohemian Rhapsody film came out, the interest in Queen, you know, really exploded. And there was lots of people really digging out stuff and finding out stuff. And I'm hoping that will kind of create that huge interest in Prince, and as a gateway for people to get in, because sometimes I've heard people say they want to get into Prince, but there's almost too much. They don't know where to start. They're not sure what to do. And I think this would be a perfect, you know, entry point.
Yes, I was going to say this earlier, Jay, when we were talking about it, because it occurred to me that there's a very apropos example of a documentary creating a hardcore fan of a legacy artist. And that would be, you know, not to, you know, talk too much about myself and my own life, because that's one of my pitfalls as a podcast host, is I like to relate everything to my own experiences and my own life a little too much. I tend to blather on and on a little bit, but for myself, I became a hardcore fan of the Beatles because of the Beatles anthology on American TV over three nights in 1994 and 1995. And yeah, that's an example of a multi-part documentary, pretty much a career-spanning documentary that showed, you know, interviews and audio clips, video clips, you know, and it was so masterfully done. And I wish Peter Jackson would do a revision of the Beatles anthology documentary and put it out, because it's been out of print for many years now, and I would love to have it on Blu-ray, just as a side note. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. But the Beatles anthology made me a hardcore fan, you know, at the age of 14, 15. And if you know, a documentary series can do that for me, which it most certainly did, a Prince documentary series can do the same for, you know, young fans in their teenage years and even in their single digit years. You know, I became a Prince fan at the, you know, very old age of 3 years old.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean,
you didn't hang about then.
Yeah. Anyone can literally be hooked at any time. It just takes the right the right circumstances, the right moment, and the right vehicle to, you know, actuate the, you know, the magic, so to speak. So,
I think that's such an important point. Just it takes, like, say, one song, one circumstance. And part of what I hope as well is I hope they get to talk. We talked about doing, you know, his whole career, and I hope they get to talk to people from every era, because we've had certain people talk early on in his career a bit, and we've heard obviously probably more about the Revolution era, which is fascinating, and I love hearing from, you know, Susan Rogers and various people. But I also, I'm really interested to hear from the NPG, from the 90s. I'm also really interested to hear from people later on in his career, kind of people are around that time. You think of Shelby J, Andy Allo, Ida Nielsen, Third Eye Girl, just so many different people from throughout his career, and to hear their stories and their reminiscences. I think it's interesting, because I think this could really work in the sense of every episode you think of the next thing, and you think, you know, people are going to be drawn in. Some people want to see the Super Bowl bit. They want to know all about that. Some people want to see the whole Purple Rain. You know, some people want to see his struggle with the record company. And I think being able to talk to everybody that you can, I mean, no, I know you might not be able to get a hold of everybody, but as many people as you can who have worked with Prince, and even in the studio, because that's my dream, that I kind of, there's some footage in the vault of him recording, you know, dream is basically to see Prince come up with an idea, write it down, work on it, and just see how that develops into a song, and see Prince at work. And I think that would be incredible, because I just never got my head. He would sit there, he would, you know, create these amazing songs. And sometimes, I think it was Maito who said it would be 3 or 4 in the morning, and Prince is screaming and laying down vocals and writing things. And it's just incredible. And I think the time I think of is actually, I think it's during Emancipation when he worked with Kirk Johnson. And a lot of the time it was just the two of them. And I think, you know, how did that work? What was his, you know, methods and his process? And I just, and the rehearsals, I mean, Prince, as we know, just when you listen to the rehearsals, you know, he didn't leave anything to chance. There was always a plan B. He had his band, like you say, he worked them hard because he worked himself hard, and he wanted them to be great because he was great. And you couldn't just go into Prince's band and kind of give, you know, your bare minimum. You had to give everything. But that was why he had the best band in the world, because he could just, you had that. He's an amazing band leader, and he doesn't get enough credit for that. And I was listening to something the other day when he was playing with Maceo Parker, and you see the way he just leads the band and the control he has in the band, you know, on the one, and it stops, and the kick drum, and he just has them on the dime. And you think the amount of effort and work that goes into that is just incredible. And the way he developed his stage persona, because when he first started, he said he was quite shy, it was difficult for him. And then he just became this kind of master showman, and he had to learn that. I mean, he had to do that for himself and to get those skills. And I think that's the amazing thing for me. And also, I'd love to hear from the artists he wrote for, their connections with him, the projects he had. I mean, there's so much there. I almost feel that there could be, you know, it could be like, I could do 20 episodes.
yes. But I agree with you, Jay. As much as a fan I am of the Revolution, which the Purple Rain era is my favorite, and I know that kind of tarnishes my hardcore fan card a little bit much, because, you know, people always say that, you know, you should, if you're a true fan, quote unquote, which is hogwash, but that's another discussion for another day. But if you're a true fan, you know, Purple Rain isn't your favorite album or era. You know, it's got to be something like the Chocolate Invasion or the Slaughterhouse or something that the general public doesn't know. But for me, the you know, the Purple Rain era and the Revolution were where I really locked in to being a, you know, really devout hardcore fan, and they'll always have you know, the top place in my purple heart, so to speak. And that's why I'm so excited and so fortunate to be able to say that I'm attending Celebration in June this year for the 40th anniversary of Purple Rain. And it makes me emotional just to think about it. But yeah.
So you'll see the revolution there.
Yes. Wow. At First Avenue, no less.
Wow. Wow.
So yes, it will be special.
Wow.
The revolution will always be my favorite, and Purple Rain will always be my favorite era. But that said, Jay, I agree that the revolution should only be the focus of one episode of a 10-episode series, because there's so many other incarnations of bands and lineups that need to receive their props, their shine as well. The proto-revolution, which I like to call the 1999 band the proto-revolution, because you have, you know, obviously Lisa there, and you know, you have Andre Simone instead of Brown Mark, and Des Dickerson instead of Wendy, but it's the bones, it's the basic foundation of what would become the revolution. So I like to call them the proto revolution. Then you have the proper revolution band, then you have the expanded revolution with Miko and Wally Safford and you know, those people, Atlanta Bliss. Then you have the various incarnations of the New Power Generation, which, you know, in the early photo spread for the liner notes of the Graffiti Bridge album, there's a photo of the New Power Generation lineup, and Matt Fink is included in that photo. But just so many different diverse lineups of just the New Power Generation alone. You know, that was the general name, you know, all-encompassing name of all these different lineups. But there were so many.
I love how that band kind of got bigger and smaller as the time goes on. And you, I think on Montreux, there was like a whole stage of people.
Yes.
It's just incredible. Yeah, yeah.
Yes. And so all of those groups and all of those incarnations of band members and lineups deserve to have maybe not their own episode, because then it would be a 20-part series, but at least, you know, they all deserve to have their chance to shine. I mean, the Love Sexy Band with Bonnie Boyer and rest in peace to Bonnie Boyer. I love her.
Yeah,
Bonnie Boyer, Cat Glover, Miko Weaver. I mean,
and that's the thing, because in Britain, I don't know if it's the same in America, but every time it was played with Prince as being, oh, he's having a comeback. And it was weird. Every time, it's like, I used to joke that Prince must have a comeback every year, because they always used to say, every project that happened, they said, oh, it's a comeback. Musicology, that's a comeback. 3121, that's a comeback. Oh, this is a comeback. And lots of those eras get skipped over, like, you know, the 97, 98 era, kind of New Power Soul, the Love for Another Charities.
Yes.
And, you know, the Rainbow Children, One Night Alone, just doesn't get, you know, the musicianship there is incredible. And yet I wonder, does the average kind of, you know, sort of not hardcore Prince fan, but how much do they know about these eras? And do, because a lot of Prince fans almost, if you look at the documentaries we have in Britain, it's almost like between, say, Emancipation and Musicology, it's like Prince just disappeared and wasn't there. And it's just, I just hope they all kind of get their moment to shine. And you think of Cat Dyson, you could Cassandra, the band of people he worked with actually just is incredible. And I just hope, like I said, they all get their moment to shine, because this is time for everybody to, and I hope when they do but it does happen, hopefully, and they air it. Lots of these people who work with Prince come out and talk about, and hopefully they'll be approached probably for, I imagine, to talk about Prince and their time with Prince. And hopefully, you know, we'll learn even more about just how incredible he is, because there's bound to be things in this documentary that are going to just blow our minds, that we just didn't have any idea that we didn't even know that we didn't know.
Right. And, you know, I hate to get ahead of myself, but like I say, I'm a real champion of physical media, and I love to collect physical media, especially print stuff. So I hope, I can't believe I'm saying this because it isn't even released yet, but I hope we get a Blu-ray of the documentary series with all the extra footage and extra interview clips and a bunch of special features, because I would love it. And I'll say this publicly, although I probably shouldn't, but I will be downloading, you know, a bootleg file of the documentary to have on my, in my files, because I just cannot not have a personal copy for myself. That is how excited I am about this documentary series.
I think that's a really good idea, actually, because if you had a Blu-ray, you could, obviously they're going to sort of clip the interview. So if you had the Blu-ray, you could have, you know, the full interview, the unedited kind of interview. You could have that whole thing. You could have extra scenes that they had to cut out. You could have live performances, because inevitably in any documentary, you edit it down quite a bit. And actually to have those full interviews, to have full clips of performances, there's so much you could do that actually,
yes,
I would love that. I would absolutely love that, because often in documentary they'll show, you know, 15 seconds of someone talking, then 20 seconds of this and 10 seconds of this, was to actually have, here's a sit down for like, you know, 10 minutes with or 20 minutes with one of the band members. I would love that. That would be incredible. That's a great idea, actually. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yes.
We need to get you advising the estate. I've told you about it.
I would love, you know, when Paisley Park first opened its museum, I put in an application to work there. Of course, it's difficult for me with my cerebral palsy to commute to Minneapolis. I live an hour away from Minneapolis by car. So I specifically asked in my application to do, you know, remote work online. And I don't think they ever even looked at my application, but it's always been my dream to work for Prince in some capacity, and I've just been so fortunate to talk to a lot of people that do have, you know, jobs within the estate, like the wonderful Dwayne Tudol, who's been on my show multiple times. You know, he's one of the official estate historians and archivists. So, and speaking to being, you know, the dream of being a fly on the wall, watching Prince record in the studio, you know, Dwayne's wonderful book series, the Prince Studio Sessions, they're just tremendous, tremendous gifts and assets, you know, to the Prince legacy and Prince fandom. And again, you know, it's weird, the Beatles connection, but Dwayne conceived the idea after reading a massive book on the Beatles studio sessions, you know, over 20 or 30 years ago. So, yeah.
His books are incredible. I mean, the detail he goes into, I can't even get my head around the amount of research he must have done, the amount of conversations and the attention to detail to know, especially when there's tracks. I love how a track gets reworked, things get changed and altered, and that kind of journey of the track. And to read that, it's almost like you say, it was like he was standing in the studio, basically watching Prince do these things, in a sense, kind of the way that book is written. It's such a labor of love, because he clearly must have put thousands of hours of research and energy into that, and they are just, they're mind blowing in their detail.
They are, and you know, to go back on topic, you know, if Netflix or Ezra Edelman were somehow able to, you know, translate, you know, Dwayne's style of work into a visual medium, that would be the ideal template for a Netflix documentary. I don't know how difficult that would be, but yeah. Interviews interspersed with rehearsal footage, you know, concert footage, archival interviews with Prince himself, because I know in the books, Dwayne always has quotes by Prince in bold, so you can see them easily. I absolutely love that approach and that stylistic choice. And I love, you know, whenever I watch a Prince interview, I absolutely get, you know, transfixed. You know, I'm a fully heterosexual red-blooded male, but there's something about hearing Prince's voice and seeing him on screen that's absolutely, absolutely mesmerizing and soul-soothing.
Yeah.
I could listen to Prince talk literally for hours and just be absolutely mesmerized. So,
there's something about Prince's voice. There's something that just, it's almost hard to explain, but it just does something to my brain. And it's just incredible. And I mean, hopefully, I don't know if Dwayne's involved in the documentary, but if ever they needed a technical advisor, I would hope they would reach out to include him in that. Because I also think it's important to point out how much you have done through the podcast and through talking about Prince and advocating. And I think that, you know, that's an incredibly important part, because that's how people show their appreciation of Prince, how they come to understand more about Prince, and they learn more about Prince. And I think that's such an important part. You basically, you know, created this amazing body of work, which just talks about just the passion, the knowledge. I mean, you know, the knowledge you have is just incredible. And the way you're just very eloquent with how you put things, and you've always been just, I think, one of the most intelligent kind of advocates and speakers about Prince's work. And I just think that, you know, that's, you've basically, you've created that. And that's amazing thing to me. Certainly when I first came online, I didn't know much about the online world. And I thought, when I grew up, I was the only Prince fan really amongst my friends. Some of them kind of, you know, they liked Prince a little bit, but not hugely. And to come online and to listen to your podcast, and I was just nodding the whole time thinking, oh yes, you know, he gets it. And it's just an incredible thing. And you know, just to be able to speak to you, and just to say just thank you, you know, for all you've done and do. And it just makes the place, the whole Prince community, it's just because Prince is positivity, and that gives me the positivity to kind of hear people just, you know, talking passionately and knowledgeably and eloquently about Prince. And I'm just so, it's weird. It's like talking to sort of just being able to talk to people that you would never have met through if it wasn't for Prince.
Yes. You know,
that's an incredible thing. And
wow. Well, thank you so much. But I have to acknowledge there were two podcasts that inspired me to throw my own hat into the ring. So
Can I guess one of them? Can I guess?
Yes.
Was Peach and Black one or not? No?
Yes. Yes.
Me too.
I have massive love, massive respect, massive gratitude toward Peach and Black.
Yeah.
And I wish they were still going, but I respect their decision to step back and focus on their lives. But I love those guys to death. I always will. The other podcast that inspired Purple Nights is still going strong, and that's the podcast on Prince from Mr. Michael Dean.
Ah, Michael Dean podcast, geez, amazing. Oh, yes.
Yes.
Incredible.
Yeah, so those two together really gave me the spark to say, hey, you know, maybe I should do this because, you know, growing up, I always had the idea of being, you know, a talk show host or sort of a late night, you know, personality, and or like a radio DJ introducing songs. So, you know, fast forward, you know, however many years later, you know, I'm doing a podcast talking to people like Jill Jones and Maite and Susan Rogers. I mean, so I'm basically, you know, with this podcast, with the Purple Knights podcast, I'm living my childhood dream. And you can't ask for anything more or better than that. And yeah, I mean, and going back to Prince's voice, I wanted to say that, you know, to me, listening to him in interviews, and especially the Larry King interview and the Tavis Smiley interviews, because I think those are the most insightful in terms of Prince's personal life. And to me, he's to use a Star Wars reference, because I'm a Star Wars nerd, and Purple Knights is actually, the title itself is actually a Star Wars reference. I don't know if I've ever expressed this publicly, but I
didn't know that. No.
Yes. Listening to Prince, he's almost like a Jedi Master at certain times. And in the song Lay Down in 2010, I was doing a show called Paisley Radio. And it was basically a live radio show streaming on blogtalkradio.com. And I did that for a year, and there was some drama behind the scenes. And I took an 8-month hiatus and rebranded and reformatted as the Purple Knights podcast. And why it's called the Purple Knights is because in the song Lay Down from 2010, Prince refers to himself as the Purple Yoda. And so my logic extrapolated from that, and I said, well, if Prince is the Purple Yoda, if Prince is the Purple Jedi Master, we, the fans, are his Purple Jedi Knights.
Nothing.
So
yeah,
I took that, and I thought, well, I've got to remove the Jedi, right? Because it's a copyrighted term.
Yeah.
it's a copyrighted term by Lucasfilm. So I could get sued if I used Purple Jedi Knights. So off goes the Jedi, and you have the Purple Knights podcast.
Wow. I never knew that. That's amazing. I love that. I love that. I just, oh, wow. I've got exclusive now. See?
Yeah, great. Exactly.
Oh, I love that.
Exactly.
Oh, it's
so,
just,
and
wow.
I'm actually considering doing a Paisley Radio retrospective podcast for Purple Knights with my first guest that I ever had on that show, a musician by the name of Cadre Armstrong, and also my most frequent guest on Paisley Radio, who appeared for a total of 3 times, was the one and only Pepe Willie from 94 East. So I'm thinking of doing a Paisley Radio reunion special with Cadre and Pepe Willie. So
wow. I was thinking of Pepe Willie the other day when the Record Store Day and 94 East, the kind of new variation came
out.
And,
yes.
Just, yeah, wow.
So I'm starting to put out feelers for that reunion special, and I really hope it comes to fruition. Jay, in your effusive compliments, you mentioned that, you know, You thought I was really, you know, could speak very well about Prince and about his music and work. I'm actually, since 2018, I've dabbled in Prince Academia, and I'm actually presenting at a conference put on by the International Center for Prince Studies. Wow. The conference is Prince on Screen. So it's Prince from the standpoint of visual media, which includes film, music videos, live shows, anything to do with visual media. And I will be giving a presentation on Graffiti Bridge, and the title of my presentation will be Lay Down Your Funky Weapon is the main title. The subtitle is Graffiti Bridge as an Avant Purple Parable of Hope.
Wow. Oh, that sounds amazing.
So I will be giving that 15-minute presentation on the campus of the University of Minnesota, specifically Cowles Auditorium, at 4 p.m. on June 17th, 2024. So if you're in the area, if you're attending the conference, I would appreciate it if you, primarily if you would attend the presentation, but even if you can't, if you see me around, come up and say hello. Maybe get a photo opportunity with me. I love that. I always post photos of me with fellow Prince fans, you know, at various functions that I meet, and I really enjoy that, which, you know, leads me to, you know, wonder, Jay, about possibly someday meeting you in person as well. I would love to do that. I would love to, if your autism allows, which I'm not sure how it manifests in you, but if it allows, I would love to give you a hug.
Oh, I'd love that. I'm a big hugger.
I think I'll turn it right back on you. I think you do so much in your work for Prince's legacy, and you speak so well and pick, you know, interesting topics, and you're always positive and you're always insightful, and I really appreciate you a lot.
That you made me blush now. Thank you so much. I'm just so proud to be a part of just being here and talking to you, and your June is going to be such an amazing month. I mean, I can't even get my, it's going to be amazing. I mean,
yeah.
To do presentation, yeah. Celebration. So when you go to celebration, are you going to, hopefully you'll tell us lots of details on online about things that have happened and the whole experience? Because I mean, it's just, it makes such a difference when we see people we respect and we know go to celebration and have that connection for people who can't go, you know.
I would love to somehow get Paisley Park's permission to document my experience at Celebration, because I know my good friend Casey Rain at Violet Reality was able to, several celebrations ago, was able to get a press pass and actually go to Celebration as a member of the press and sort of officially document his experience with Paisley Park's blessing. So I would love to be able to do something similar. I asked Casey about that, and their Paisley Park has had a turnover in their team that handles that sort of thing. So things are different now than they were several years ago. So I wouldn't know where to begin to ask about that. But yeah, I would love to be able to document my experience and share it with viewers and listeners of my podcast. Definitely, that would be something.
Because that's an amazing thing. I mean, it's something that very few artists have, is it? A celebration that Prince had, because very few people. I mean, Paisley Park is such a unique place, and it's strange because it becomes this synonymous creative powerhouse for Prince, and to build that park. And, you know, he built it where around the people he loved, the place he loved. And I think that's one of the things I love about Prince as well. He always represented Minneapolis. He didn't say, I'm going to go and live in, I don't know, New York or London or wherever. He said, you know, I love Minneapolis. That's where I'm from. That's what I love. And I just love the fact that that was where he, and I think that helped musically as well, because I think that's just what, you know, so much of his creativity, where he grew up and the way he was different from everybody else. I absolutely love that. And the celebration is something that's one of the things that just seeing everybody from all over the world just come together, just, you know, it's something that just really moves me. And I think that, wow, it's just, you know, one day we'll be there, and yeah, I'll be grabbing you for a hug straight away.
Sounds great. I look forward to it. And yeah, that's one of the aspects I personally love about Prince, because I'm a Minnesota guy through and through. I was born in Minneapolis, lived most of my life, my formative years, in Minnesota. Love all my Minnesota sports teams, and I just love the area. It's in my blood. It's in my soul. So I definitely bond with Prince over that aspect. And like I say, that does nothing but deepen my love and respect for Prince as one of our own, so to speak. You know, a local guy, a boy done good, as they say.
I remember when I very first got into Prince, and I think one of the first things was the Love Sexy tour, and you see Prince with, you know, MPLS or Minneapolis along his sleeve, and you see the way he's just so proud of it. And I just love that, because it's such an integral part of Prince, you know. And there's something about Minneapolis, the Minnesota area, because, you know, you had Dylan as well, haven't you? I mean, Dylan, Prince, you seem to have some creativity there.
We have two absolute musical legends from Minnesota, and I'm sure there are more. Yeah. Like, to a lesser degree, the group Soul Asylum, which Prince loved and which he covered on the Welcome to America album, they're also from Minneapolis.
Wow.
And very well known. And so we've had a great musical history. And to read more about that, the great Andrea Swenson, several years ago, she wrote a wonderful book called There's Got to Be Something There.
Yeah.
The History of the Minneapolis Sound, dating all the way back to the 50s and 60s in downtown Minneapolis. A great, great book. And Andrea is so great. I've had her on the podcast as well. It's amazing the caliber of people that I've talked to, and people like, you know, Andrea and Susan Rogers. I mean, my goodness, Susan Rogers is still my absolute favorite guest that I've ever had on. I've had her on twice, and she's retired now, so I imagine she enjoys, you know, being away from the limelight and not talking about Prince as much. I imagine we'll hear from her this summer some more, just because of her being so heavily associated with the Purple Rain era. But I would love to have just the slightest excuse to have Susan on a third time, because she's such a great guest and has such great stories and insights on Prince as an artist, you know, in the recording studio, and then also is kind enough to, you know, extrapolate a little bit on who Prince was as a person, you know, respectfully so.
Yeah, I love the way she would make things happen as well. There's sort of stories where she had to create new ways of doing things, things that hadn't been done before, and to fix these solutions. And it was just her ingenuity and practicality. And like you say about, and with Andrea Swenson, just the whole Minneapolis scene, I think Prince sort of said that, you know, you have to create your own scenes in Minneapolis in some ways. And by doing that, people created a different sound. And the Minneapolis sound now, to think, I can't imagine a world without the Minneapolis sound. I mean, my life is the Minneapolis sound. That's what I listen to all the time. So it's just incredible.
Yes,
it's not just Prince. It's the whole scene is just extraordinary, really. Really extraordinary.
Yeah.
Oh, that's probably a good place to actually leave. I realize I chat on for ages, otherwise I'm terrible. But I just want to say thank you so much. Is there anything else you'd like to say? I just want to say before that, thank you, because it's just made my day, especially today, to get to talk to someone I respect so much. And there's so many things you've said that I'm going to be thinking about. So just thank you, really.
Social media. I'll say the first thing is social media. So I'll give all my social media. It's facebook.com/PKPodcast is the Facebook page. The Twitter or X page is @PKPodcast. The YouTube page is youtube.com/@PurpleKnightsPodcast. The Instagram is Purple Knights Podcast. And the TikTok is Purple Knights Podcast.
Excellent. I'll put all those links also in the show notes so people can click through. Yeah.
And then also, I just wanted to say, I believe that things happen for a reason. And I think us meeting here today and talking and connecting is a very important thing. I know I deliberately chose this day, but I think there was some sort of higher power, whether it was Prince or, you know, the being above him, we all know who that is, that led me to choose this day, because it was really important for me to connect today and talk today and get my thoughts out today with somebody who gets it, because it's a tough day for all of us. Just to tie it back to the beginning, it's a tough day for all of us. So to be able to connect with somebody who understands the gravity and the solemnity of the day is very, very powerful and very, very healing, and it's spiritual food. So thank you so much for taking time out of your day to speak with me today, and it's done me a lot of good. So, and thank you so much for inviting me on Night Child Talks Prince Uncut and Unscripted. It's a great podcast. I've saved every episode on my hard drive. And I have a dedicated folder, so I'll be able to listen to every episode whenever I want, which is great, because I love what you do. I appreciate it. I respect it endlessly. And just thank you so much.
Thank you. It's made my day. Thank you so much. It really has. And I just hope you have a nice rest of the day. You've still got a day to sort of the day to go. So I hope that, you know, your day is good to you, and you get to play some Prince.
Yeah. Well, I hope you have a good night and get some good rest, and think happy thoughts, and have lots of musical dreams filled with the Minneapolis sound.
I will. Thank you so much. Oh, you take care. I'll look after yourself. See you soon.
You too.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, kids. Bye.
Welcome to Night Child Talks Prince, uncut and unscripted.